long time we did this show in the 10 o'clock hour. And then a few months ago, Dr. Suzanne said, can we switch it to the 11? And we said, of course. I don't think we ever formally made a point of saying it's switched, but I'm doing that now. So in case you hadn't noticed, we changed the hour, but the day is the same. It's just a different time. And it's still the same idea. She comes here usually prepared to talk about a few things that might be new or things that have been in the news that have to do with women's health. We can talk about that. But also the idea here is that it's a resource for people who are listening to ask questions. I always try to remind people that we cannot diagnose over the phone. So there are limits to what we can do. But we're doing these shows to add to your knowledge about health. And if you have a question, this would be a good place to start. You can ask some basic questions, and then you may indeed want to go on from there and pursue it with your own doctor or a doctor who at least can see you. But having said all that, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
There are a number of things that you suggest we might talk about, but one thing that you did say has been in the news lately, so maybe if you want to do that, we could talk about that. And that is some concerns about the contraceptive patch, birth control patch, and some concerns about the hormone levels that women are going to get when they're wearing the patch. And in fact, here I have a story that's been clipped out of the newspaper. This came, I think, from the Wall Street Journal, saying that, in fact, some doctors have stopped writing prescriptions for it because they're concerned about the levels of hormones. What do you think about this?
Well, the patch, like birth control pills and like the vaginal ring, have both estrogen and progesterone in it. And the progesterone probably helps to suppress ovulation, and the estrogen helps to stabilize the lining of the uterus. They work in synchrony together to provide contraception. Also, these are medications that actually help to provide many, quote-unquote, non-contraceptive benefits. So suppression against having ovarian cysts and fixing irregular mm-hmm. bleeding, for instance. In some cases, control of endometriosis. And there are a number of other what we call non-contraceptive health benefits. But one of the problems is that the contraceptive benefit is strongly tied to the level of hormone in your blood. And if you skip a birth control pill, then your level of hormone drops down, and in fact, you're a little bit more risk for pregnancy. So when we say that what is the risk of contraception when you take pills, it's about a failure rate of maybe less than 1 person out of 100 will get pregnant at the end of a year with quote-unquote perfect use. But with quote-unquote typical use, we miss at least 8 pills during the year, and we're more likely to miss them earlier in the cycle, and that's more likely to lead to through breakthrough ovulation. When you take pills over a 5-year period of time, you have to take something like, you can do the math, 365 times 5, but it's over 1,500 pills. So that's a lot of health behaviors. So in an effort to minimize the number of health behaviors and stabilize the level of hormones, both to improve contraceptive effectiveness and to decrease the risk of side effects like irregular bleeding, which you also get from missing pills, the pharmaceutical industry has come up with these what we call longer cycle alternatives, or something where you have to do less health behaviors. And with the patch, you just apply the patch once a week for 3 weeks, and then you leave it off for a week when you have your period. So that's 3 health behaviors per month. And indeed, it showed that with typical use, the failure rate's less. And with perfect use, maybe the side effects like breakthrough bleeding are less as well. But the consequence is, by using this patch every single day, the hormones go up and they stay at a certain steady level. If you actually drew a blood level of estrogen hormone with a pill taker, the estrogen level when you're due to take your pill first thing in the morning is quite low. And after you take it, it gets into your bloodstream, it spikes up much, much higher. So on the pill, you get higher and lower excursions, and low, it becomes very low if you skip a pill. Mm-hmm. Whereas the patch stays very, very steady. And a a journalist actually kind of thought about this and sort of took some research a little bit out of context and said, oh, well, the patch should cause more blood clots because of this phenomenon. And there's a little bit of research that seems to link that. But when researchers really got to think about it, they realized that if you calculate the quote-unquote area under the curve, so if you're calculating approximately how much estrogen is in your system, average pill user versus average patch user, you have a 60% increase in estrogen hormone level when you're on the patch. And this higher level of estrogen might, in fact, be a problem. So we know that estrogen affects our liver, and we know that the liver is the site of production of clotting factors. So if you overproduce clotting factors, you're going to have a slightly increased risk of having that blood clot if you're on the patch and not on the pills. And that's what a lot of the controversy is about. Now, I think some researchers or some clinicians are pretty much ignoring the whole thing, saying, but it's still so safe. And the risk levels of somebody having a blood clot so low that you really don't need to do anything special for the average person. Some clinicians are kind of backing off a sort of a mid-level position that they had. I think some clinicians felt that the patch was going to be safer for against blood clots because it avoids that first pass effect, shouldn't have therefore as much effect on the liver as something taken orally. And I think they were being more flexible about giving patients who were, say, over the age of 35 and still did some smoking. I think clinicians were being a little bit more flexible about giving those people the patch instead of the pill. Now that's, we've realized that can position backfires. I think I'm trying to take a middle ground approach as well. I think, number one, it's important to notify patients. And I'll get to another story that was in the news media about the so-called black box warnings. I'll get back to that in a second. So in case I don't, you ask me about the black boxes. But I think it's important to notify the patients about the research. And I think it's also a consideration to talk to patients more carefully about their history. And there are blood tests that can be done looking for people who actually have inherent greater risk to throw a blood clot. In our population, one of the more common factors, particularly Caucasians in our area, about 6% will carry either heterozygous or homozygous, so either a carrier of the gene or actually having the two copies of the gene, so more likely to have the condition of something called Leiden factor 5, and that predisposes you to increased risk of clots. That's a blood test that can be done. We don't do it on every person because it's an expensive blood test, but it's something, for instance, we could order on patch patients if we want to be sure she isn't in a special risk category. And I think I'm going to be more strict, even in my younger patients that do smoke, and advocate that they reconsider their methods other than the patch. But we do have to remember that for many medical conditions, that if you have a contraindication to taking the pill, you may also have that same contraindication toward being pregnant, because pregnancy produces very high estrogen levels as well. So you have to always weigh what we call the risks and benefits for patients and try to empower the patient to look at the evidence and help you decide, rather than just blanketly deciding for the patients.
So now I'm supposed to ask
about
the black box.
Ask me about the black box. So I think they're going to end up putting, if they haven't already, in the issuing a new package insert with a black box. The FDA has come up with this system where very important, actually extremely worrisome information regarding any particular drug, it has a black line drawn around it. It's actually, the whole box isn't black, but it's just a black line drawn around it, so that when you're glancing through the package insert material, which the PDR, the physician's desk reference, that's in every library and most doctors have a copy of, it's a compendium of all the package inserts of all the currently available medications. Well, every package insert that does appear in this PDR will, on any particular medicine where the FDA thinks it's important enough to have a warning, will put that warning information in this so-called black box. So just draw a line around it. And recently, I think it was a pharmacist, and I don't remember her name, but I think a pharmacist published information where they quizzed physicians about their knowledge regarding black box warnings in typical medications. And they found that physician knowledge of these black box warnings is actually, as a group, significantly lacking. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that there's an awful lot of information to know about medicines, and sorting through the important and unimportant can sometimes be a chore. Secondly, sometimes these warnings are issued after you've already read the package insert when it didn't have a black box warning. Now this is issued and things are sent out and media gets out about it, but maybe we're not thoroughly even notifying. Maybe we need a better system that physicians can learn about these black box warnings. And I don't know that anybody's come up with a complete answer to this, but it is a little bit worrisome. And I always, when I lecture to my medical students, I always tell them, read the PDR. And of course, patients might read it back to you if you don't, but like these kinds of things mm-hmm. do appear in the media. But understanding what that black box warning is all about is very important. Actually, there were black box warnings about hormones long before Women's Health Initiative made everybody realize that there was a link between older patients and continued hormone replacement therapy in menopause. But because I think some of the physicians weren't paying close enough attention to exactly what that black box warning said. And in fairness on the physician side, some of these black box warnings are vague. They say things like, consider the risks and benefits. And they leave it at that. They don't, it's not, you must prescribe in these situations, you should not prescribe in those situations. There are contraindications, a contraindication section, but some of these black boxes are a little bit more vague.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you one other question that occurs to me about the patch then. One of the things that we know that has happened over the history of oral contraception is at the very beginning, the doses of hormones in the pills were very high, and that was thought to cause some problems. And then also it was determined that you could get the desired effect, you could get contraception with a much lower dose. I mean, if the amount of hormone that women are getting is an issue, has anyone said, well, perhaps we don't need to put as much hormone in the patch?
In the patch. Well, I am sure that is what they're thinking, and you're absolutely right. About 98% of all the hormone have been taken out of those early birth control pills. Of course, we have to think back in time. This was a time prior to a home pregnancy test. It was a time prior to the blood pregnancy test that we even have at the hospital. They literally had to kill the rabbit to figure out if you were pregnant back in those days. And unfortunately, that used to be the big medical student question. Why did the rabbit die during pregnancy tests? Well, then they had to kill it to look at its ovaries, but sort of sacrifice. I'm sure there's better terminology. But and so that is, in fact, why it was designed with 3 weeks of active pills and a week of inactive pills to approximately every 28 days give a woman a withdrawal bleed so that she would know that, in fact, she wasn't pregnant. Otherwise, if she just didn't have a period, she didn't believe she wasn't pregnant. And there was no way to check that because there were no home pregnancy tests. So a lot has evolved, but I think you're right. They're going to discover that lower dose patches can be extremely effective. And I bet somebody's out there with their drawing board figuring this out. And mm-hmm. I think the same warnings are going to have to come from the vaginal ring. It's a little bit different mechanism. And I don't know if they've calculated the total dose of hormone from vaginal ring, but I'm sure we'll see that soon.
Suzanne Trupin is our guest in this part of Focus 580. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School. She's with us once a month on a Monday on the 11 o'clock hour. We talk about women's health. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Actually, something that occurs to me that I thought I would bring up, and we've talked about this before, and that is that taking pills in 3 month batches.
Yes.
We have talked about
the
fact.
With the seasonal.
Okay. I guess I was just interested because now I've been seeing advertising of pills that are packaged that way. I mean, we've talked about how in fact, in the past, it's been determined, first of all, that there's no real reason to have a period every month, and that for some women, it might be good if you could fix it so that they wouldn't have a period every month. And you said, well, you know, that doctors have known that for some time, and in fact, that one of the things that you could do is you could prescribe that way. You could say, here's your prescription for your pills, take 3 months' worth, and then stop, and then have a period. Well, now there are some pills that are actually packaged that way. You get them, you get 3 months worth. I'm wondering how common that is becoming now. How many women are taking pills?
Well, it's
that way?
More common, but it's not going to completely take over the market. We estimate that about 50% of women taking pills the way Cesenal is packaged will have some irregular spotting or breakthrough bleeding. And because of that, some patients are unhappy with that. Also, packaging those 3 months together is fairly expensive, and compared with paying for one package at a time, depending on if you have prescription coverage or not. So that's been a little bit of an issue. They're also going to be even longer cycle pills designed so that you do not have a period at all. And probably the acceptance rate will be about the same as with Cesenal. So I think it's going to be more and more common. I think there's still a little bit of a knowledge gap. Some of my patients have seen ads for Cesenal or seen something in the media about them, but still many of my patients, when they come in for their regular checkup and are taking a regularly packaged contraceptive pill, when I discuss the fact that they can have longer cycles, more patients have heard of it, but it's still not universal. And some patients feel that may not, quote unquote, be healthy because they're so used to having that with regular with monthly withdrawal bleed. So we still have a lot of education to do about how, as you say, it can actually be more healthy. Mm-hmm. And you can have less anemia and less menstrual cramps and less endometriosis and actually fewer failures. There was just an article published in, I can't remember if I was talking about this in a lecture or if I actually mentioned this in the last show, but there was just an article published about the pill Yasmin. And when studied, and I was part of this study group, but when studied in the traditional formulation way, didn't treat PMS, or it was a severe form of PMS, PMDD that we were looking at. But when reformulated, so there were fewer pill-free days, so instead of 21 on, 7 off, it was 24 and 3, 24 and 4, I guess, however you do the math. And with that formulation, it actually was very successful. And so it was thought that it had to do with the overall steadiness of the hormone levels. And with only 3 pill-free days, you didn't drop down low enough. And so the medication was still effective in treating PMS and PMDD. So longer cycle pills are going to be looked at more for these non-contraceptive benefits as well as contraception protection.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question talking about birth control. I had my second child 3 months ago. And when my first was born, I went on the mini pill, I think 6 or 8 weeks after he was born, with the doctor said that was no problem. I'm now in a different city with a different doctor, and she said that I could use the mini pill, but not until my period had started, with which my first took 11 months to come back because I was nursing. Just wondering why the difference in opinion, if anything's changed in 2 years, or if that's just...
Well, no, it must be some a little bit of prejudice on the part of your physician. The medical terminology for mini pill are, I call them POPs, P-O-P, progesterone-only pills, and they don't have any estrogen. Truly, probably the lower dose regular birth control pills are just as safe, but it's always been a theory that the estrogen, even in low dose pills, might reduce the milk supply. We know that these hormones cross over into milk. Your own hormones are crossing over into milk, and babies can handle these low doses of hormones, metabolize them out, and have no medical consequences from it. We don't usually recommend that you start these progesterone-only pills too soon, too immediately after delivery, like even Depo-Provera, which is an injection form of progesterone-only. We want you to get at least 5 days out from the delivery because of theoretical consequences on clotting factors. But there's been no change in recommendation in terms of when to start it, as long as you get to that 6 week point. And if you want a website where you can find a lot of information, there are many of these, but World Health Organization actually prints out their indications and their risks and what they suggest as to when to start. And they go through all of it, all the different hormones and the injectable progesterones versus the quote-unquote mini pill. So I think somehow, as near as I know, this is something your individual physician has as a prejudice, but I'm not sure why.
Okay, so generally 3.5 months to start a mini pill.
Well, usually we write it at the 6 week checkup, and we don't anticipate that you'll have a period, especially for breastfeeding. We wouldn't anticipate that you would have a period yet. You just start taking them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, other questions are welcome. We're about at a midpoint here in this hour. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. What would you like to talk about next?
Well, we were talking about medication, so I thought I'd talk a little bit about the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the quote-unquote antidepressants. And there's been a new epidemiologic study. It was somewhat powerful in that it was a Dutch study that looked at their database of 850 patients. I think we've talked about this before, that the Scandinavian countries keep vast national databases, and they can sit down and do research on huge numbers of patients. And they looked at their database of 850 patients, and specifically were seeking out anybody who had been on an antidepressant for at least 1 year or more. And then they looked at their risk for bleeding. And of course, my field is gynecology, so I was reading the literature based on what they found relative to uterine bleeding, but in fact, I think that other rates of bleeding were increased as well. And I don't know that they have exactly worked this out, but apparently there are some antidepressants that are stronger serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and so the stronger ones would be things like the Prozac and Paxil, and some of the very early ones are weaker serotonin inhibiting uptakers. And they think that based on their epidemiologic look at this literature, that perhaps even switching medications might help if you find yourself suddenly having heavier periods and so forth.
I think that there's been some concern about this maybe for a little while. And as you say, I think it affects all kinds of bleeding there. Particularly, I think I've noticed people who have, for example, it causing problems with stomach bleeding or intestinal bleeding.
That literature as closely, but we always have to think when there's anybody presents with a medical problem, we always have to think drug interactions and what can your drugs cause. Of course, we talk a lot about what can your herbal medicines cause, things like grapefruit increase bleeding, and what else are you what home remedies do you take? How much, of course, aspirin's an obvious one if you talk about GI bleeding, but there's so much more to know because there's so many more medications.
Yeah. And that's why it's really important for people to be upfront with their physicians about what they're taking. If people are seeing more than one doctor, make sure the doctor B knows what doctor A has prescribed and vice versa. And then if you've decided that you're going to treat yourself and that you're going to try something that's available over the counter, that it's really a good idea also to tell your doctor about that. Make sure that they know everything that you're taking. And I think particularly maybe if people are taking psychiatric medications, it may be that they're not going to want to be completely open, tell all their doctors about that.
I think that was much more true years ago than it is now. And I think to some extent, if you don't show up at your doctor's appointment with a physical list of what you're on, sometimes it's just hard to remember. Mm-hmm. Plenty of us have, as we're leaving, we say, oh, I forgot to tell you. And that's so troublesome. When we do research studies, it's really tough to track this down. And this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, because in research studies, we have to put down, if somebody was given 1 week of medicine, we have to write down whether they took the full 7 days or they they started late or stopped and restarted. We have to put down exactly what goes on. But for most of us, when we leave our doctor's office, we leave with a prescription in hand. We wander over to a pharmacy, and that's the last the doctor knows of it. And we're not actually, as physicians, notified when that prescription even gets filled. And then, of course, just filling the prescription doesn't mean it was ever even taken. And I think that we need a little bit more feedback from pharmacies directly to physicians regarding what medication was picked up and so forth. I mean, we rely on the patient reports, and often they're fairly accurate, but I think sometimes they're not as accurate.
Yeah.
So that's a problem.
Well, and I think it's that it's also true that patients often say they're confused about the directions about how to take the medicine. And it was not very long ago, I remember reading some articles about someone saying, well, maybe there, in fact, ought to be a more standard kind of labeling, because there are different labels in addition to the label that says take 2 pills every 4 hours or something. Then there are other little things they stick on there that said, take this with food or don't take this with food, or, you know, other
right.
special kinds of instructions, and that people get really confused about what it is that they're supposed to do. And if you get your prescriptions filled at different places, the labeling may be different. So that's going to confuse
right.
people even more. And I know for doctors, it's really hard to get people to take the medicine the way they're supposed to in the first place. And if the directions are confusing, then that's not going to help.
That's true. And with getting back to the contraceptive literature, we always say the most important instructions are what to do when you don't take your medicine right, and to make those very accessible. When I do research studies, back in the 80s when we did a research study, maybe a consent form would be a page long. If it got to a whole page and a half, we'd think it was long-winded and complex and overly burdensome. But now for many of my research studies, we have 15 pages of consents. Now, some of these studies are only a couple of weeks long. Some do last a few years long. And the consent often will say, well, now if this happens to you, this, this, and this will be next. And if that happens to you, this, this, and this. Well, the patient gets so confused thinking, all this is going to happen to me? Well, no, but they're trying to cover every base. And I think sometimes this even happened with these package inserts that we were just talking about. They're so thorough now that it's hard to get the forest from the trees.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly have time for other questions. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an OBGYN. This is our monthly program on women's health. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. What else would you like to talk about?
Well, not very long ago, the International Society of Clinical Densitometry, which is the organization that oversees the performing and the interpreting of bone density tests, has actually changed some of their recommendations and their measurements. I know I spend a lot of time on the show talking about the disease entities of osteopenia and osteoporosis, and they're actually recommending that we drop the word osteopenia. They're trying to get that to just be interpreted as quote-unquote low bone mass. I think by giving it a name makes it seem more like a disease. And I think they want to, and I've talked about this before, and they haven't standardized this one aspect. They want to be able to tell patients based on their age and their bone density, what is their 5 or 10 year risk of having a bone fracture? Because sometimes people can have very worrisome sounding low numbers from getting their bone thickness tested on one of these machines, but yet they're so young and healthy that their actual statistical risk of fracture may be elevated for their age, but it's still not high. And so many of the researchers are feeling like these kinds of things should be taken into consideration. They're also redoing how they interpret the findings so that we have, if anybody ever gets a full copy of their bone density report, they might see a number for quote-unquote Ward's triangle, and then it became Ward's region because it turns out it's a square, not a triangle. But Ward's region is listed out, and a few years ago, we stopped interpreting Ward's region, and now they want to stop interpreting the greater trochanter, feeling that not specifically that the measurements aren't accurate, but they're less accurate for prediction of fracture risk. So they're looking at total hip or the neck region of the femur. And so we're going through our last several hundred bone densities to see if any of our patients who we interpreted their reports would have actually changed recommendations based on the newer ways to interpret the bone density. So it's getting more complicated. And I'm not sure, other radiologists may feel that, well, they read it with the rules that were in existence back then, and they'll go forward rather than looking back, which probably is acceptable, given that people will see their healthcare provider within a year.
Okay. Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone listening in Bloomington, Illinois. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I would like to know a little bit more, sir, doctor, about thyroid gland, in particular hypothyroidism after the childbirth, and if the blood results are slightly elevated. Is there any alternative treatments? I read in a book like that increase in supplement of the iodine, selenium, or magnesium, and I just would like to know their doctor's opinion about that.
Okay, well, it is important to have enough iodine to be able to, your body to be able to synthesize enough thyroid. But because because we don't have much iodine naturally in our soil or our water, we get a lot of our iodine in our society from salt supplementation. So if you're somebody who completely eliminates salt from your diet, you may be deficient in iodine, but that's very rare because salt is in so much. So for most of us in this region of the country, iodine deficiency is very rare. Also, magnesium is in so many foods that it would be very rare. And you'd also need a fairly restricted diet to be deficient in selenium. But selenium is also a minor component of what we need for health. We also know that if your intake of soy is too high, it can slightly throw off your measurements as well. In pregnancy, our body produces half again as much blood volume. So anything that we measure during pregnancy actually changes relative to your measurements before and after pregnancy. So the first thing that's important for a physician to do who's interpreting blood work for somebody who's recently had a baby is to try to figure out how to interpret that blood work. Is it, should we interpret it as if the person's still pregnant, or are we far enough out, which usually that means 6 weeks after the pregnancy, to interpret it as if she was no longer pregnant? And that will change. There are other hormones that are produced by the placenta that can affect how the thyroid is produced. And there's also some other physiologic changes that may factor into how much thyroid the thyroid gland itself is producing. So all of that can change and it can be transient, but it's fairly easily measured on a blood test and monitored from there.
Okay, thank you. And would their nursing of the baby would affect their results of their thyroid test?
Maybe and maybe not. Early on in pregnancy, when prolactin is released, it can affect the thyroid gland very slightly. But as we get farther out in nursing, those hormone levels stabilize. So we don't usually interpret the results based on whether or not you've still continued to breastfeed.
Okay. And so is there any alternative to medication? Because I guess my doctor would like me to try taking a very low dose of medication for hypothyroidism, and I would like, you know, to find some alternative, you know, maybe change my diet or get the supplement. What's your opinion? Is it possible, or should you think I go ahead and start medication?
It's probably something where you and your physician are going to need to talk, and probably medication is going to be the pretty standard answer, and I don't think that we have any herbal supplements that can really adequately replace those levels. And thyroid's such an important hormone in terms of functioning of the rest of our body that we all want to be stable in our thyroid level.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your answer.
Thank you. We have someone who must be listening on the internet. They're in Colorado. Marion, no, I'm sorry. No, that's Marion County. Oh, okay. Yeah. Jason puts in here Marion CO, and I'm thinking, oh, Colorado? No, Marion County. Very good. Marion County, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I had another thyroid question. I'm in past menopause and had my thyroid tested, and it is low, and they put me on Armour thyroid. But the T3 is not responding, and they want to put me on, like, Synthroid. But I've read so much about it, Synthroid causing osteoporosis. Is there any other way that you know of to move the T3 to normal range?
Well, any thyroid supplementation is going to be associated with a slightly increased relative risk of bone loss. Now, that doesn't mean that osteoporosis will be produced. That has to do with overall what is your bone density when you first start taking the medicine, what's your rate of bone loss, what are some of the other factors that are preserving your bone health. So being on thyroid medication is not a universal prescription for causing osteoporosis, but it is something that is very important to get our listeners to realize that when you're on thyroid medicine and you're in menopause, you do want to get your bone density tested and be evaluated for other risk factors of bone loss if, in fact, the values are low. So it wouldn't really matter whether you were on either. And the different thyroid medications are slightly different. Many people can be stable on any one of a number of products, but some people are more stable on one type of product or another. Other people have to do other tricks with their medicine, like chew their pills so that they get better blood levels and some things like that. But many endocrinologists feel that it's important to get both types of thyroid hormone stable, both the T3 and the T4. Others feel that one or the other is more important. That starts to get beyond gynecology and into endocrinology, but you do want to comply with your physician recommendations in terms of what blood level you want to be at when you're taking that medicine.
Do you know why I know so many women who, after pregnancy and when they go into menopause, their thyroid turns...
It is more common as we get older. Pregnancy itself, there are rare conditions where people lose a lot of blood and many of their hormone or their endocrine systems shut down, but that's fairly rare, and that's with a tremendous amount of blood loss. But there may be other factors that we don't completely understand yet, and aging is definitely a factor. So it's not universal, but it is more common as we move through life.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. And again, others who have questions are welcome to call. We have about 15 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think one of the things you said you were interested in talking about was miscarriage. I'm not sure in what respect.
Well, miscarriages are very common. The medical terminology might be considered a spontaneous abortion, meaning completely miscarrying on your own. There are conditions called missed abortion, meaning that the pregnancy has died, but the pregnancy has not passed from the body. And of course, the first question usually is, why did this happen to me? And we think that so much is tied to the chromosome count of the fetus that was developing. And there was a new study to show that, yes, in fact, the chromosome abnormality rate in patients having miscarriages is extremely higher, even to the point where in some age groups, those under 20 and those over age 35, the rate of chromosome abnormalities was 61%. And in women over the age of 40 who had a miscarriage, the rate of chromosome abnormalities was 87%. So very often we're looking for hormone reasons, maybe something wrong with the ovary, maybe something associated with endometriosis, perhaps something associated with the uterus itself, maybe a heart shape instead of an egg shape. maybe something about the sperm, but most often it still comes down to a chromosome abnormality in that pregnancy, and that's not usually something that we can specifically fix, per se.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I think is true, or at least I've heard over time, is that the rate of miscarriage in women who have conceived for the very first time, that is their very first pregnancy of their lives, is relatively high, and then in most women that goes down, and that the chances are if you're going to miscarry, it is most likely that you're going to do it when you're pregnant for the very first time. Is that actually true?
Well, they say about one in it depends on how you ask the question. If you try to follow the fate of every ovulated egg, the miscarriage rate is extraordinarily high. Mm-hmm. But if you follow the fate of everybody that comes in is about 5 to 6 weeks pregnant, probably that changes what question you're truly asking. But statistics seem to show that approximately 1 in 4 people will miscarry their first pregnancy, and it goes up to about 30% with the second pregnancy, about 35 when you've had 3 miscarriages, and it never gets up higher than about 50%. So it stops going up. So maybe people don't try mm-hmm. too much past that.
Okay. We have a couple of callers here. Champagne is next, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I have a diagnosis of a tumor in my pituitary gland, and as a result, I have elevated prolactin level. And I'm working now on getting pregnant, and I'm wondering about the possibility of breastfeeding.
Well, for most women, these tumors are very small, and they are usually treated by medication that is safe to take during pregnancy if your prolactin levels rise, but that typically we can try to get patients off that medication when they're actually pregnant. Then after pregnancy, we weigh the risks and benefits. If somebody has something called a macroadenoma, bigger tumor versus a microadenoma, the macroadenoma patients can't get by without getting back on their medicine or possibly staying on their medicine when they're pregnant. And then after pregnancy, there's this question, if you're on the medicine and suppressing the prolactin, will that affect breastfeeding? And basically, it's something that you're going to have to work out with your individual physician. So they'll follow your levels. They'll see how the baby's doing with the breastfeeding. They'll see how your levels are doing when you breastfeed. They'll decide whether or not to give you the medication, and then again see how effective the medicine is in spite of being breastfed and how well the baby's doing. So the quick answer is most patients can breastfeed, but it will take some monitoring.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next is someone calling on a cell phone. This is our line 4. Hello.
Yes. Your caller that you had a little bit ago talking about her thyroid, for what it's worth, I've been on Synthroid since I was, it's been over 30 years now, and Synthroid seems to be the only thyroid medication that will keep my levels regular. I have no sign of osteoporosis, and I realize everyone's different, but I just thought that might encourage her.
Well, thank you for calling.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Anything else you want to add? I know it's difficult.
Yeah, you know, Synthroid has been around a long, long time, and it did suffer a little bit of a PR problem in that its research to the FDA was so old, the FDA made them go back and repeat some of it. I think this was a number of years ago. Could have been 10 years ago already. And I think it got some poor press at that time. But it is a good medication.
Okay. Matt Toon is the next caller. Line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I'm wanting to talk about bladder infection. I've had 2 rounds of Bactrim. And now I feel like it's starting again with a really low back pain. And I wondered what else you could take or you would prescribe.
Well, when it comes to bladder infections, what they need to decide is this urethritis? Is this cystitis, just the bladder itself? Urethritis would be the urethra. Or is there some component of of the kidney and the ureters being infected, which is a condition called pyelonephritis. And so first, to get an accurate diagnosis. Second is to figure out, are there contributing factors? Intercourse, for one, causes some introduction of bacteria. And so sometimes the correct way to help prevent recurrent infections is to give low doses of an antibiotic right after intercourse. Also, what you want to do is get an accurate diagnosis. So getting a culture taken before you get treated and get started on your bacterial medicine, and then getting a culture on the back end when you've completed your medicine to assure that, in fact, the bacteria is completely gone. And as we get older, a contributing factor can be the amount of what we call atrophy of that region. So the tissue, if not exposed to estrogen, can become weaker and more prone to developing infections. So sometimes actually hormone therapy can be helpful. So there are a variety of things that can be done, and probably a visit to the doctor before the infection starts and after the infection concludes is the best way to get started.
Well, I'm taking Avista, but I've gone off of the hormones. I had them for 30 years.
Well, Avista is what we call a selective estrogen receptor modulator, and it acts like estrogen on certain parts of the body, like bone, so that's a good thing in terms of prevention and treatment of osteoporosis. And it acts anti-estrogen on other parts of the body, and it's currently being studied as a possible prevention for breast cancer. But we feel that Avista is relatively neutral when it comes to the effects on the vagina, so that it won't help toughen up that tissue or either cause or prevent bladder infections. But understanding this class of medication, SERMs, there are many new SERMs that are either being tested or about to come out on the market, and understanding the effects of SERMs on the vaginal tissues and whether or not people get more bladder infections or less bladder infections or more.
Well, I hadn't had any for ages, and then lately it's just happened.
Yeah, and sometimes it could just be a bug that isn't thoroughly treated by the medicine that you were given, and something simple like what we call culture insensitivity. So the laboratory can grow out whatever organisms are causing the infection and give your doctor a report of how likely those organisms are going to be to respond to each of a number of different antibiotics. And then from that test, the physician can have a clue as to what else to pick that might get a more of an eradication rather than just a suppression of infection.
Oh, good. Well, I'll have to call and then get another test.
Yeah, that's usually what it means. They're trying to come up with some over-the-counter tests for urinary tract infections. There are some that are a piece of cake. You just dip a stick into urine and look at it in a few minutes, but I don't know that they ever went over the counter. I know they were talking about it, but I don't think they did. But I think they were relatively expensive, maybe took a little bit of expertise to read. But
I bet.
All the over-the-counter stuff, it's fascinating. Of course, as I say a number of times, I work in research, and many of the medications that we are working on not only are available in other countries, but even over-the-counter in other countries.
Isn't that the truth?
Even birth control pills are over-the-counter in many, 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 many countries. Mm-hmm. But it's been a big fight. Even, you know, another thing that was in the media, the big fight about whether or not the morning after pill should go over-the-counter, which is, of course, just a couple of days worth of the birth control pill.
Isn't that terrible to refuse them?
Well, thanks for the call and good luck.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. We're just coming down to the point where we have maybe about a minute or so left. Is there anything you'd...
The
1 minute drill.
Oh, let's see. I think the other thing in terms of the bone density that I wanted to mention is that women who are premenopausal and men under the age of 50, we do have to use their Z-scores to interpret. And Z-scores are not interpreted exactly like T-scores when it comes to bone density. And I talk to a lot of patients who seem to have gotten a confused message regarding their bone health. So I guess my one-minute message for bone density testing is to get tested and to sit down with your doctor with the report and try to understand it.
Okay. Well, with that, we'll say thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, always on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, she's here. We talk about women's health. And thanks very much.
Thank you.
This broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. At the staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. A quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Susan Starr Sarid. She's research director of the Religion, Health, and Healing Initiative at the Center for the Study of World Religions at the Harvard Divinity School. We'll talk about her book, Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. Then in the second hour, we'll be talking about some of the concerns that have been voiced recently about safety and transportation around the campus of the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking with three guests. We'll have William Gray, who's the Director of Public Works for the City of Urbana, Rahim Benikwal, he's a professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the U of I, and Bruce Knight, planning director for the City of Champaign. That's tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned, because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, and the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about crows and us, humans, and the interactions between crows and humans. Our guests will be the authors of a new book from Yale, In the Company of Crows and Raisins. Ravens, excuse me. Had a long weekend. John Marsloff and Tony Angel will join us at 106 Central Time. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices are lower. December wheat trading at 296, down 1. March 312, down 1/4. December corn 187.5, down 2.25. March 201.75, down 1. May 210.25, down 1. December 238.75, down 1/2. January soybeans 550.5, down 3.75. March 557.5, down 4.75. May 563, down 5. November 578.5, down 5. December meal 168.50, down 160. December oil 2102, down 11. January feeder cattle 116.65, that up 62.5. December live cattle 92.62.5, unchanged. December lean hog 63.30, that up 75. February bellies 89 even, that 55 higher. January crude oil 56.